desensitize and counter condition. So we want to get the dogs used to the thing that they're a bit worried about or frustrated by gradually. And then we also want to change how they feel and what their response is to you.
Are you crazy about Chihuahuas? Maybe you're wondering if a Chihuahua is the right dog for you. Perhaps you have a training or a behavior struggle. Well, look no further. Here you will find expert opinions, honest views, training and behavior advice, and much more on the Chihuahua Podcast. And now, allow me to welcome your hosts, Kate Masterton and Haley Miles. Over to you, ladies.
Welcome back to the Chihuahua Podcast. This week, we are bringing you a listener-requested topic, Chihuahuas in Rescue. And we are joined by Senior Behaviorist from the Dogs Trust, Tom Candy. And we will be discussing a whole host of different rescue Chihuahua related topics, including reactivity, muzzle training, how to bring your Chihuahua home from a rescue and the time that they need to settle in, and a whole lot more. And I hope that you enjoy this episode as much as me and Haley did. So, hello Tom, how are you? Nice to have you on the Chihuahua Podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Yeah, I'm really good, thank you.
That's good. Did you have a good week back? It's bank holiday. It's just past the bank holiday weekend now. So did you have a good weekend?
Yeah, it was nice. I had a wedding on Saturday and then I went camping Sunday, Monday. So saw some friends I haven't seen for a long time. So it was very nice.
Lovely. Yeah, we had some quite good weather. So, Tom, it's great to have you on the Chihuahua Podcast. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself, please? And how you got started?
Yeah, definitely. So originally I wanted to be a vet. I'm not a vet. But what that did was get me out to do some work experience, because when you're applying for veterinary universities, you have to have a certain number of weeks of work experience. So I started volunteering with a small rescue in South Wales called Hope Rescue when I was 15, just doing sort of fundraising and home checking and that sort of stuff, not really working with the dogs, but it really sort of ignited my passion for working in rescue, and I knew that's kind of where I wanted to be. So I went to university, studied bioveterinary science as an undergrad, and then I went on to study clinical animal behavior as a master's. And then started working at Dogs Trust. So I worked as a training and behavior advisor for about 3 or 4 years. And then I did some locum in, so traveled to different centers to cover where there was sort of sickness and help support some of the new teams at our centers. And now I work as a senior training and behavior advisor. So I oversee 7 centers across the Southwest, supporting them with anything to do with training, behavior, and welfare. So it's quite a varied role. And yeah, I'm a certified clinical animal behaviorist with ASAB and a full member of the APBC.
Oh, wow. Okay. So you'd rather be doing this than being a vet?
Yeah.
This is your passion, more of a passion thing?
Yeah, definitely. I think it was sort of, you know, I'm just coming out of that sort of age group where, like, if you wanted to work with animals, it was kind of vet or that sort of thing. Like,
it was
still kind of limited behavior degrees. I think it was less seen as like a career. And then whilst I was studying my biovet degree, I kind of realized that actually behavior was the direction that I wanted to go in. I had a lot of opportunity while I was studying to do puppy classes and observe behavior cases, because they had an on-site clinic, and it kind of made me realize that actually this is the route I wanted to go down. So
I totally get that. So Do you see many Chihuahuas, because this is a Chihuahua podcast, do you see many Chihuahuas coming into rescue? And what's the main reason for Chihuahuas coming in? It's probably varied, but what's the main reason for them coming in?
Yeah, so we see a few. Like, it's definitely not one of the most sort of common breeds, but you do see them. I have a lot of photos on my phone of me with Chihuahuas that we've had in the rescues that I've worked at. At the minute, we've got about 12 in across 22 centres, not a huge proportion. But yeah, we definitely do see them, a mixture of short and long-coated. And yeah, you're right. It really varies the reasons that they come in. Some, it's the sort of standard things. You know, the owners had to move house or change jobs and don't have the time to support their needs. Sometimes it's slightly older ones who've been living with some sort of older people who have passed away or gone into homes, care homes. And then sometimes it is sort of for behavior reasons. But obviously, being that little bit smaller, I think it's sometimes less of a concern than with some of the other breeds that we get.
So the behaviour issues you do see, what's the most common things that you see with Chihuahuas?
So probably reactivity.
I think I know what you're going to say.
Yes, probably reactivity. Sort of mainly snapping at people and reacting at dogs, I think. It's probably the most common stuff. They seem to be quite good with handling, luckily.
Oh, really? Oh, so you don't have too much...
Yeah, I think it depends. Like, we've definitely had some where... Definitely worked with some where handling is more of a concern for them. And you can see why, you know, they're constantly picked up and pestered, aren't they?
Yeah. Yeah, a lot
it's
of them are...
surprising.
More of a sort of manhandled than handled, I think, sometimes. But definitely. But yeah. And, you know, reactivity, I think you're in agreement with me. Reactivity in Chihuahuas is the number one behaviour problem in, you know, for the breed, as well as aggression towards people. But I think reactivity towards other dogs is so prevalent. It's unreal.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I would say it's definitely the number one thing, isn't it, that people ask about. How do I stop my Chihuahua shouting at the dogs, you know?
Oh, constant. I see it constantly.
It's so common.
Yeah. One of the things that sort of really got me interested in training and behaviour early doors was my parents went to a car boot sale and came back with Victoria Stilwell's first book. So I think it was just It's Me or the Dog.
I have that somewhere.
Yeah, I have it on my shelf somewhere over there probably. And thinking back to those episodes, obviously it was filmed quite a while ago, but I always remember the one episode with Chihuahuas where she got the owners to sort of lay down on the floor and say, look how scary the world is if you're, you know, 3 inches tall. And I always kind of remember that. Because it's not really surprising that we see that sort of reactivity issues when everything is much bigger and much scarier than they are, even if they don't necessarily think it all the time. But also we kind of have sort of that culture, like we've just mentioned, haven't we? You know, they do kind of get manhandled and picked up and carried around and potentially miss quite a lot of opportunities to learn some better options for interacting with other dogs, I think.
Yeah. And I don't think we can drum it into people enough that, you know, living in a gigantic world, this sort of giant world that they are sort of thrown into, is so intimidating for a lot of them, isn't it?
Yeah,
there's a lot to deal with. There's a lot to handle. And then sort of being picked up willy-nilly whenever you don't even know when you're going to be picked up. Suddenly you're sort of swooshed up in the air and you don't really have a lot of choice when you're little, do you? Because people can do a lot of stuff to you.
I guess that is one of the other issues that we do see with handling is quite often they lose a lot of their communication, don't they, Chihuahuas? Because nobody really pays that much attention to a Chihuahua who's sort of waylying or lip licking or turning their head away when you compare it to sort of a Rottweiler. So I think a lot of their communication gets ignored. And then we do end up with a situation who, you've got a dog who's picked up, doesn't have any escape options. And then those hands come towards them because they're cute and fluffy if they're long haired or slightly less fluffy. And, you know, the only option that they have is to snap and say, no, thank you.
Yeah, exactly. And just go straight, like you said, just go straight to that bite with their weaponry, because that's all they can do.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and absolutely. I think, like you said, with the larger dogs, I think the body language is probably more noticeable to people, like the general public, in a larger dog. Like if a larger dog freezes and stares at you, even if you don't really understand dog body language, you're going to be like, oh, it might make you think a bit more if it was a Rottweiler doing it rather than a Chihuahua doing it, aren't you?
Yeah, definitely. It links more into our survival, doesn't it? Whether it's, you know, a Rottweiler or a Labrador or anything who's sort of slightly bigger, you do think, oh, actually, that might hurt a bit.
Predator. Yeah, predator.
But yeah, with the Chihuahuas, people don't think it, although obviously it's Chihuahua podcast and I think they're brilliant. And quite a few people have said, you're going to end up with a Chihuahua one day. But unfortunately, one of the very, very few scars that I do have from working in rescues was a Chihuahua.
Okay. And what happened there?
Oh, so it was just in the vets. And obviously being so small, sometimes it's quite hard to find sort of a muzzle that fits well.
Yeah.
And he just got himself really worked up in the vets. And as we were stopping, because obviously we don't if it's not an emergency, we don't want to push through dogs who are struggling with the vet. We want to make sure that we can put some time aside to work on that and make them feel more comfortable. But yeah, he just got the muzzle off and just flung around. And obviously, yeah, being so little, there's not really much to hold.
No, bless him.
So, you know, nothing major, just a tiny little mark. But obviously, we then gave him some time to recover. And
going back to what Kate was saying about the bigger dogs, you know, we are going to take notice, but a lot of chihuahuas, you know, especially, and also when they're being aggressive, do get laughed at. We, you know, a lot of people think it's quite comical for them to display aggressive behaviours. Maybe not when someone's getting bitten, but, you know, when they're snarling and growling, they it's a comical thing, isn't it?
They are the ones that you see on TikTok and YouTube and stuff, aren't they? Where they are kind of really, really trying not to bite. And like you said, people are just laughing because it isn't as threatening as they might think it is, unfortunately.
It's a real shame. And something we're really passionate about here on the podcast. So sorry, Kate.
That's okay. We're going to keep telling the people that they need to respect their chihuahuas and listen to their body language.
That's it. And I think sort of generally, like, there is that lack of understanding, isn't it? Like, you point some stuff out to people and they quite often the response is like, oh, I've never looked at it that way before, or I haven't thought of it like that. And I think sort of across the breeds, there is sort of a lack of understanding of body language. And I went to Crufts recently and I was there with a friend and we were at Discover Dogs and he was doing a lot of sort of stroking of the dogs and putting his head right close. And as we walked away, I was like, you really need to not do that. And he was like, well, why? I was like, because like they're meeting a lot of people. And yeah, they hopefully they're coping well in that environment because that's what they're there for. But I was like, I don't know if your face needs to be right next to them. And, you know, it's just that kind of people just don't think, do they? And the majority of the dogs are going to be absolutely fine. But like you said, it's more about, yes, reducing the risk of bites and keeping people safe, but also maintaining welfare of the individuals, because like you said, it's a pretty hard life as a chihuahua.
It is. I think people need to realize that the same way that people don't like random people coming and touching us and getting in our space, dogs feel exactly the same way. And I think that is a bit of a surprise to people, isn't it? They're surprised that, oh, don't dogs just like everyone touching them? But no, they have social currency with people, don't they?
Yeah, and that's it, isn't it? And lots of organisations have done work around sort of how to appropriately approach a dog, and obviously for smaller people, children, you're making sure you ask before and stuff. But I guess as soon as the dog is off the floor and at people height, it's even more enticing, isn't it? Because it's just right there for you. Because I think probably less, I mean, I don't know, there's sort of no evidence for this comment, but I guess particularly for me, there's such a long way down that I'm probably not going to reach down to a chihuahua. But if they're in somebody's arms, you are much more likely just to try and say hello, aren't you? Because they're right there for you.
Yeah.
When someone's got a chihuahua or a small dog in their arms, it's almost like it's an offering, like a gift. Do you want to touch my dog kind of thing? You know, like they're there anyway. Yeah, people are more likely to touch, like you said, Tom, touch the chihuahua or go. And actually, you know, if someone's holding a chihuahua, then that person is more likely just to stare at the dog.
But you know about staring, how we tell our kids, don't stare because it's rude. People need to apply that to dogs as well, don't they, Tom?
Yes. Yeah, that's a really good point, isn't it, really? You don't really think about it, but it can be quite threatening to just be looked at a lot.
Yeah, because if we walked into a room and everyone was staring at us, we'd be like, whoa, this is weird. Yeah.
Yes, kind of that country pub, what film is it? The Hot Fuzz feeling, isn't it? Where, you know, you're not from round here.
Yeah, you're not local. Yeah.
So my next question was going to be about the most common issues, but we've just covered those, and reactivity being the number one issue that we see with chihuahuas. What do you do to address those issues that you do see in the dogs that come into rescue?
Yeah, so it's really about identifying what the driver for that is. So particularly if we think of reactivity, we're mainly probably going to be looking at sort of fear or frustration, or maybe a combination of both. We've already talked about how a lot of the times the chihuahuas are up in people's arms and then have that option of taking themselves away, that flight response removed from them. And then that in itself causes frustration because there is that barrier to that control of your environment. So quite often we get that combination, but we want to make sure that we really know what's the driver for that behavior, what the motivation is. Do they want the dogs to go further away, or do they want them to be closer, or why are they performing that behavior? And then think about what we want them to do instead and use that as a way of changing the emotion. So what we want to do is desensitize and counter condition. So we want to get the dog's used to the thing that they're a bit worried about or frustrated by gradually. And then we also want to change how they feel and what their response is to them. So the way we might start that is looking at teaching a different behavior with chihuahuas being little, maybe a target stick. If you're a bit taller like me, or just a response to their name, or just licking back at the handler, and you teach that away from the trigger, so other dogs or people, whatever they're reacting to, and then gradually you bring the trigger back in at a distance where they're coping, and you gradually reduce that distance so that they learn, when I see this thing, if I do this, good things happen. So if I see a dog and I look back at my owner, I get some yummy treats, or I get to play, or whatever the dog enjoys. So we're starting to change that behavior. And then in turn, that changes the emotion, because we're starting to pair other dogs or people with really yummy treats or a really fun game. So that's kind of the basis of any plan that we're going to work on with reactivity. And then obviously we're going to tweak and change stuff depending on the individual. And I guess the only other thing really to mention is, what we don't see a lot of probably is chihuahuas wearing muzzles. And I think that's an interesting point, isn't it? Because like I said, even the dog that we had, and there was a different situation, but I've got a video of a dog who we were trying to give eye drops to, and his eye was sore, so he wasn't really appreciating it, which is absolutely fine. And we'd had to use a bandage muzzle because actually we couldn't get a muzzle small enough. But what we've got to remember is that we still, even though they're little and the damage isn't going to be as much, we still sort of have that responsibility to try and keep people safe. And if they are going to approach and not listen to owners, really, we should sort of be thinking about muzzle training that chihuahua as well. Even if they don't need it all of the time, it's such a great skill for them to have if they do need to see the vet or something. But yeah, it's something to think about, isn't it?
Muzzles, I absolutely love that, because I was thinking about that the other day. And no, you don't see... We don't see it ever with, you know, chihuahuas being muzzled, only at the vets with those, you know, those close fitting muzzles, not the basket muzzles. And I think there's a lot of benefit for teaching a dog to be muzzle trained, like you say, Tom. And one of them, there's many, but one of them is as a deterrent. So if you see a dog with a muzzle on, you're less likely to approach that dog, aren't you? So even as a deterrent to other people, it's really good. But in terms of muzzles, do you have a preferred muzzle that you use for tiny dogs?
I think, like you said, whenever we look at muzzles, we kind of want to make sure that they are the basket style, so that they allow enough room to pant.
Yeah.
Ideally, easy to get treats into, because obviously we still want to be able to reward the dog for making good decisions. So we do use the Baskerville ones a lot, but they are... Yeah, they don't always go quite as small. Bioethane muzzles are useful because a lot of different people do them sort of made to measure. There is a fairly new company called The Muzzle Movement who make really great muzzles. I'd have to check what size the smaller size is, because at the minute they've only got a limited range. But they allow a much bigger pant room, and they're really big gaps. And they're all customizable with different bioethane straps. So it's a hard muzzle. And then they've got different colored straps, so they're a bit friendlier looking.
Yeah, because some of them look like, yeah.
Hannibal Lecter.
Yeah.
But like you said,
yeah.
Sorry. Well, I was going to say, like you said, one of the things I was going to say is actually a lot of the time people can be quite worried about using muzzles or the perception that it brings, but actually, like you said, it really gives you sort of a layer of security for the dog as well, because you are less likely to be approached and less likely to have hands going towards that dog if they're wearing a muzzle. So actually sometimes it can really work in the dog's favor. And like I said, even if they're not wearing them all the time, if they're comfortable wearing it, and you can just pop it on if you do find yourself in a situation where there is, you know, you go to the park and there are a lot more people or kids than you're expecting or whatever, you can just pop it on and you know it's not going to affect the dog's walk, because hopefully they're super happy wearing that muzzle.
And something that's really important, and the muzzle should not be something to, you know, you haven't failed your dog if you have to muzzle your dog. You know, it's actually a really good thing to teach them, isn't it? To be definitely happy wearing one.
Yeah, it's just like any other tool that we use with our dogs. So like a collar or a harness, you know, is there for a specific reason in a specific situation. And that's going to vary for each individual. So yeah, my dog's got a muzzle. She never wears it, but she's comfortable wearing it. If she did ever need to see the vet when she was painful, or if we needed it for any other reason, I know I can just pop it on. And it's not going to add more stress to a potential already quite stressful situation like seeing the vet.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, actually, is that it's something that you would train and get them conditioned to in a normal situation, the same way you would with a harness. You condition them to wear the muzzle, because yeah, the last thing they want is when they're in a painful, say they've got injured and they need to go to the vet, is then having to deal with this strange new thing on their face.
Definitely. And like any training that we do with our dogs is a great form of enrichment, and hopefully they really enjoy it. So it's just another thing that what we should be seeing is you get your muzzle out and the dog's really excited and really wanting to engage with that muzzle. And then that's when you know you've made that sort of positive conditioned response. And hopefully, yeah, you know, I've got some brilliant videos of some of the dogs that we work with, and you know, they're almost pushing their handlers over because they're so keen to get their nose in that muzzle, because they know it's going to lead to really good things happening for them.
Yeah,
that's amazing. So, Tom, what would your advice be to someone who's looking for and wants to adopt a rescue chihuahua?
So first thing is make sure it is the right dog for you. So yeah, there's tons of information online now. Some of it's good, some of it's not so good, but just read some different places, find out some information. Ideally, try and speak to some people who have chihuahuas. Obviously this podcast is a great place to start, and then yeah, try and meet some if you can and just see the different styles, because within breed we get just as much variation as in between breeds. So you know, just because you've met a couple of chihuahuas and they've been this way doesn't mean the one that you potentially get is going to be the same. So it's really important to try and get kind of a big variety of dogs to say hi to. And then when you start sort of looking, try and go through sort of a reputable rescue who's got good support for you. So if anything does happen or change, you know, they're on the end of the phone, they can offer you some advice and give you the right support. And then once you've sort of found a chihuahua that you're interested in, yeah, make sure you can meet them, spend a bit of time with them, see if they do match your family. And then just remember that it can take some time for them to settle in, and particularly if they've been in kennels, or even if they've been in a foster home, they're jumping into a new situation and environment, and we need to just give them some time to settle once they are in our space, because it might take a few weeks for them to sort of start to show their true colours. So we just want to take things nice and easy, keep things quiet, and gradually introduce them to the things that they're going to be exposed to when they're living with you.
Absolutely. Going back to if the dog is the right dog for you, if a chihuahua is the right breed for you, if you're looking for a quiet dog that's not going to shout a lot and bark a lot, maybe a chihuahua is not necessarily the right dog for you. And I know that we've talked a lot on the podcast about they bark because they're scared, you know, if they're in pain, but they also bark because it's intrinsically rewarding for them. It's an activity that they like to do. So maybe a chihuahua is not the dog for you. Do you want a quiet dog?
That's it, because barking's really interesting, isn't it? Because like you said, one of the reasons that they can do it is they might be a bit worried about something. And what we then see happen is normally, rightly or wrongly, like if it's to do with them or not, that thing that they're barking at moves away. Because if it's another dog, they're probably on a walk with their owner and they're walking the other direction anyway. Or if it's a postman, the postman's the classic example, because the post comes through the letterbox, your dog barks and the postman walks down the drive, and to your dog they think, yes, I scared off the scary postman, but actually we know the postman was going anyway because he's just going to go next door. And same for cars that are passing. So it has that sort of intrinsically reinforcing point of view, like you said, of, well, actually I barked and that scary thing went away, so that's what I need to do next time. But also it kind of just feels good, like it is communication, and we don't always know what the reward is, what the consequence for that behavior is, but it is, you know, releases hormones and things that makes the dog feel much better. So yeah, of course they're going to do it more. It's just some dogs feel the need to do it more to start with, and then that kind of creates a bit of a cycle of the barking becoming stronger and happening more frequently, like you said. And it's just unfortunate that chihuahuas are often a breed that do like to hear their own voice.
Yeah. And like you said before about those differences within the breed, because you're going to get quieter chihuahuas. I've got a very quiet chihuahua and I've got a very noisy chihuahua. It just likes to shout for the sake of shouting.
That's it.
Yeah.
And I've got one that is very, very, very shouty. And unfortunately, because I had her like 8 months old, and I think a lot of she's come with a lot of baggage. So her barking was definitely reinforced a lot, I think, before she came to me. So I've been asked this before. Okay. I've been asked this quite a few times. When are you going to do an episode about rescue chihuahuas? Because I've just taken this chihuahua on. I don't know what to do. Or I'm having this chihuahua come into me soon. Like, we have some fosterers on that listen to the podcast and things like that. So I have quite a few people ask me that have just taken on a rescue chihuahua, maybe from a neglectful or like a hoarding situation, because that does happen a lot as well. There's lots of chihuahuas in one house and they haven't maybe been socialized. And stuff like that. So what would your advice be for someone who's just taken on a rescue chihuahua? Because I do find a lot of people do kind of rush into things and don't know how to kind of, you know, sort of help them decompress.
Yeah. So like I said earlier, I think one of the big things is just keeping things nice and quiet to start with and giving them that chance to get used to the new environment. But one of the sort of best ways that I like to think of it and that I found somewhere, and we never sort of identified where it came from originally, but it's called the rule of three. So that's where you sort of think about the first 3 days. There's a lot of change happening for that dog. They're in a brand new place. There's lots of new people. They've lost kind of all of that predictability that they may have had before. And that's sort of really stressful for them. And that's when they might be a bit more quiet, and where we really want to just kind of have nice, quiet walks. Short walks to start with and keep things sort of easy in the house. Just work on some really easy bits of training or something interesting for them to do if they're interested in interacting with you. And if not, just providing them a nice safe space, so a comfy bed in an area where there's not a lot going on, there's not sort of people walking past all the time, and giving them that chance to get used to being in a new environment. We know it can take a couple of days, sometimes even weeks, for sort of cortisol and other stress hormones to drop down and for the dogs to start sort of relaxing a bit and taking that deep breath. When we move into the first 3 weeks, that's where things start to become a little bit more consistent. They're kind of getting used to the house. They're starting to feel a bit more secure there. They've hopefully built a better relationship with people in the house. They're getting a bit more used to their walks. And we can start to introduce some newer walks, maybe a couple of new people, depending on the background of the dog, and sort of build their experiences up that way. And then when you get to 3 months, hopefully that's where the dog's really settled in. We've seen a really good relationship build between the dog and the new owners, and you can start, you know, even opening the world up a little bit further for that dog. And another way that I kind of like to structure things came from a colleague, and we started using it for dogs who are really frustrated and quite grabby. So not necessarily chihuahuas in the most case, doing a lot of lead dragging, but it's sort of based off a traffic light system. So a standard traffic light system of green, amber, red, and you kind of grade activities that dog does. So it might be a walk to a specific place, or it could be grooming, for example. And you say, right, okay, well, Max the chihuahua really likes food enrichment toys, and he really likes the walk to the local graveyard because it's really quiet. And he really likes being groomed with a soft brush, but he's a bit more worried about meeting new people, or he's a bit more worried about walking along the road. So you'd go, right, okay, well, all the ones that he really likes, they're my green activities. And the ones that he's a little bit more worried about might be my amber activities. And then if there's anything that we know is an issue, like he really doesn't like the vet, or he is really, really worried about other dogs, we're going to keep them as our red activities. And to start with, first few days, we might only do green activities. And then when they're a bit more settled and we've started to build that relationship, like we've already talked about, we can maybe introduce an amber activity, see how the dog copes. And then we can say, right, okay, well, we'll do one amber activity today. And then we know tomorrow and maybe the day after, we need to just do green activities to give them that chance to get back to baseline, get back to their sort of standard level before we then introduce another amber activity. And then once we get to the point where hopefully some of those amber activities are becoming greener, we can then introduce a red activity and drop that down to amber and work through it in the same way. So it's quite a nice thing for people to do and sit down if they've got the dog already, or if an organization who's rehoming the dog knows the dog quite well, sort of writing that down on paper and color coding it in a bit of a it's like a reverse pyramid, I guess, isn't it? Or hopefully a pyramid, because you want lots of greens, not so many ambers, and hopefully only a couple of reds or no reds at all. And then people can see, and it's much easier to pick what activities. So I think a lot of the time, you know, we sort of expect to take a dog home and then we want to be doing, you know, our half an hour walk in the morning on the school run, or, you know, we straight away, we kind of picture where we want our dogs to be. You know, often the reason that we've got a dog, like nice long walks or socializing with friends or going to a cafe and sitting with a dog, like that's definitely sort of a highlight for me, like more likely the pub. But, you know, especially as we're moving into summer, being able to do a nice long walk and then go and sit in a pub garden, have some food or just have a drink and have the dog with you and chilling. Mm. Well, that might be 6 months time, but for a lot of the dogs that we take in, that's not going to be sort of the first week. So really being able to look at the activities and say, well, actually, yeah, he had a bit more of a slightly stressful day today, so tomorrow we'll just do green activities, really gives the owners and the dog the best chance of being able to settle into a new environment and decompress, and then hopefully progress into having a really happy life together.
I absolutely love that. Yeah, I love that. And it's so simple to use, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's it. And like, you can have as many or as little activities as you want. And it's just always that idea of being able to fall back on activities that you know the dog's going to like. You know, and some people talk about sort of serotonin breaks, don't they? Where, say you've got a chihuahua who's reactive to other chihuahuas, and you go on a walk, other dogs even, and you go on a walk and you see four other dogs on that walk, that's probably going to be quite stressful for the owner and the dog. So maybe tomorrow, like, do we really need a walk? Like, are they going to become really ill if they miss one walk? Probably not, as long as you provide them with good activities in the day and obviously appropriate opportunities to toilet if you don't have a garden. But, you know, we don't necessarily need to go straight back down to the park where they saw all of those dogs yesterday. So it's a much easier way to sort of visualize that, I think, than just saying to somebody, well, just don't walk your dog tomorrow because they've had a bit of a stressful day today, because they can see the activities that they can choose from that they know are the dog's favorite activities or the ones that they're slightly more worried about.
Yeah, I like that.
I was just going to say there would be some activities that would be red and they'd stay in the red, wouldn't they? There are going to be activities that a rescue dog, maybe from a really neglectful background or something, would never be able to do because they just can't cope with it.
Yeah, potentially. And I think that's why what we want to do is, like, when we've got those red activities, you kind of leave them alone a little bit to start with. And then once you kind of make your way through some of the ambers, the reds drop down to amber, but they, like you said, they don't just go straight to green. And then we can look at it and say, well, actually, yeah, we've got to this point and that's okay for us and that's okay for Max. And some activities might move further down. And I guess it's all about sort of being really realistic with your goal setting and thinking about, like, where you are. Because, yeah, so for example, if you've got a dog who's really, really worried about the vets, like, you hopefully will get to the point where the dog can see the vet a bit more happily or tolerate the vet visit. But are they probably ever going to really, really love the vet? Probably not. If it's a dog who's been in an environment with lots of other dogs and really struggled to cope with that, are they going to be a dog who can go to daycare and run about with 50 other dogs? Maybe not, but can we hopefully get to the point where the dog can walk the other side? You know, you can cross a road and then your dog isn't kicking off at the dog the other side of the road. I think that's a lot more of the times a much more realistic goal, and actually still kind of achieves what you want, because you can walk through town without your dog kicking off at everybody. It's just you have to remember to cross the road if you see another dog coming towards you.
Yeah, absolutely. And getting those coping, learning those coping skills for the owner and the dog.
Definitely, yeah. And that's it a lot of the times, isn't it? Like, when we work with owners, it's not just about what the dog is doing. It's about paying attention to your environment and making sure that owners are picking up on things and looking at, well, is there a car that I can just pop behind whilst we're working on our training? Because we've always
like ninja
got
ninja move.
Yeah, that's it. We talk about a distraction dance, so we teach
distraction dance.
Yeah,
okay,
again, that's, yeah, one of my colleagues came up with that. That's definitely not a me thing, but that idea of having a toolkit that we can utilize when our dogs are about to or have gone over thresholds. Because when we talked about reactivity earlier, you know, that plan that I sort of briefly mentioned is like your best case scenario. There is going to be a time where you're working, you might be working with another dog at a distance and it's all going really well. And then a dog comes around the corner and you're much closer. And that's our potential opportunity to just throw some treats down on the floor and get the dog's nose down, or hide behind a car, like we said. Or sometimes you've just kind of got to really encourage the dog away from that situation and then think about our decompression and what activities we might need to do after to get the dog to calm down, rather than worrying about what's happening in that second. Because if you've got a dog reactive dog, chances are at some point your dog is going to bark at other dogs, regardless of how careful you are. And it's
going to happen. It is going to happen. Yeah.
So we just want to be able to say sort of, oh, well, this happened and I know what went wrong and I know how to hopefully fix it next time. And I know that I've given my dog an activity to calm down after, so that they're not going home and still feeling aroused and wound up and possibly a bit worried.
Yeah, because you can't manage every situation, because that's just not real life, is it? Sometimes you just have to deal with the situation that comes along.
Yeah, the only reliable factor of management is that it will probably fail.
Yeah, management fails. But yeah, I really like that, because it's also, it's respecting the dog as an individual, isn't it? Because we've talked about this before, haven't we, Hayley, about you're never going to make a dog that's not particularly sociable into the most sociable, loving Labrador puppy, because that's just not who that dog is. So it's also like respecting the dog as an individual, isn't it? And what their limitations are.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that setting goalposts is something that I'm sort of really keen on. And particularly for rescue, we talk a lot about sort of the good enough dog or the good enough home. So, you know, if we've got a dog who's not available for rehoming, at what point do we put them up? Like, do they need to be able to say hi? Do they need to be able to say hi to every other dog that they see? Or actually, my example of, can you cross the road and then the dog doesn't react? Like, that's probably enough for most owners. And that's kind of thinking about those goals that we set for rehoming, or those goals that we set with owners if we're working with them post-adoption or just before the dog goes to rescue, is really important. And something, yeah, I talk about a lot when I do conferences and things. I think it's really important that we're setting the dog up for success and the owners by making sure that everybody knows kind of what our realistic goals are before we start.
Yeah. You do see a lot of unrealistic goals, and I'm going to touch on this, with the dogs that come from abroad. You know, there's the street dogs, the dogs are in compounds over in Bosnia and Romania and places like that. So you do see a lot of, and I don't know how many chihuahuas or chihuahua type dogs that we see coming over from those countries, but in general you find that a lot of owners do unintentionally kind of have unrealistic goals that, oh, next week we'll be able to go to the pub and sit down for a drink and my dog will be just relaxed and stuff. Whereas in fact, you know, a dog coming from abroad is not going to be your average pub Labrador. It's just not going to happen, you know. So I think it's just meeting the dog where it's at and looking at the dog in front of you is really, really important.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess the brilliant thing with setting appropriate goals is you can always surpass them. But if you don't set, you know, if your goals are too high to start with, all you're really going to get is frustration and then sometimes a bit of resentment, because like you said, you've got a dog because you do want to go to the pub and then it never happens. Yeah. And we did have this with a case once where the owners really, really enjoyed doing long walks, but they had a dog reactive dog and that made it quite difficult. So we had a conversation about, well, what's the dog like when she's left? And the owners were like, yeah, great, sleeps, no problem. But, you know, we don't like her leaving her for sort of longer periods of time, like a couple of hours. Like you said, you have to look at that individual case and think, well, actually, yeah, the number that gets thrown around a lot is that 4-hour mark, isn't it? Like, you shouldn't really leave dogs for longer than four hours. But some dogs cope perfectly well with being left for longer than that. And often overnight, we leave them for 12 hours or eight. Well, 12 hours. I wish I could sleep for 12 hours. But, you know, they're left for 8 hours overnight, aren't they? Because they're downstairs. They might not have access to the toilet. Now, should we do that every day? No. But if it's affecting your social life and your relationship with that dog because you can't do what you want to do, rather than putting the dog into that situation, you might actually be better off just leaving them at home for a slightly longer period of time if it's, you know, a once a week thing or not very often, and the dog copes. And I think that's the really important part. Obviously, if the dog is distressed by being left for longer periods of time, then that's a much different conversation. But if, like my dog, they jump on the sofa and then they jump off the sofa and go into their bed and then jump onto the other sofa, I don't think she really knows if I'm gone for 20 minutes or 4 hours, because the response is kind of the same when I get back.
Yeah.
And I think, yeah, like you said, we've really got to think about our expectations for our dogs, but also people, because it is a two-way relationship. And we know that dog owning is fantastic and is, you know, a really, really great thing. But you have to make sure it's right for everybody.
Definitely.
There has to be compromise. There has to be give and take. Absolutely. Give and take.
So some people think they don't want to get a rescue dog because they want to get a puppy, because a lot of people think that puppies are a blank slate. What would you say to people that maybe think that? Or what would your advice be?
That is a really common misconception, isn't it? And I've even thought it myself sometimes, like, oh, if you had the time, it'd be really nice to get a puppy and then you can sort of create the ideal dog that you want. But we know, in reality, that isn't sort of the case. You know, we've got genetics to contend with, which is something that we can't change. We've got early socialization and habituation and basically how good the breeder is. And we have some control over that, because we can obviously go to reputable breeders and meet the parents beforehand and look at how that dog's going to be. But the reality is they're all so individual, and one thing can happen when you get home. So, you know, the first time you get home with your puppy and then a loud bang happens outside, you could still have a dog who becomes afraid of fireworks, regardless of how much was done in that the home with the breeder. So there's so many different factors that it's kind of impossible to ever have a blank slate. I think one of the benefits with rescue dogs is not always, but often you have a better idea of what you're getting, because, you know, we've already sort of passed through those maturity stages and the sort of fear periods and different socialization stages, which means that particularly if you've got a good home history, you kind of know what that dog might look like on the other side, but not always. But I think it's just really thinking about what will fit best into my lifestyle, because puppies might be great for some aspects, but they take a lot of work. You know, it's toileting every time they eat and drink and play and wake up from a nap, and then every 20 minutes in between, you know, that's a lot of up and down in to hopefully get them toilet trained as quickly as possible, especially with, you know, chihuahuas where they've got such a tiny little bladder. Even 20 minutes might be too long to start with. And then it's all the training that you've got to put into them. Obviously, that still happens with rescue dogs too. But if you get a slightly older dog, then they might be quicker to toilet train if they're not sort of toilet trained already, and generally may take less sort of time during the day. But it's really about, like we said earlier, setting the dog and yourself up for success. And if you're really set on a puppy, just knowing like what good puppy classes are in the area and you know, how to puppy proof your house so that you don't have chewed corners of a very expensive table or whatever you're worried about doing. But it's kind of the same when you then get a new rescue dog. It's thinking, like we've already said, how do we make this as easy as possible, a transition for the dog and for us?
So getting a puppy is not a guarantee that they're not going to have behavioural issues, just the same as getting a rescue is a guarantee that they're going to have a problem. And I think it's really important that people look at all of the pros and cons. Like with a rescue, is it a good rescue? Have they actually got a behaviorist on team? Because not all rescues are created equally. And same with breeders, not all breeders are created equally. It's looking at the big picture, isn't it?
And that's it. And I think it's about getting that part of the picture right. So where is the dog coming from, regardless of where it comes from? Because ultimately, what you want is a person who wants the best for that dog, but also for you. So you don't want a rescue who just gives you any dog you ask for because they want the dog rehomed, because what we want is to make sure that the dog is going to fit in with the owner and it's a successful rehome. You know, so the dog isn't brought back to the rescue after a few weeks because it was just a bad match. And that's kind of the same with a puppy. You know, you want a breeder who can see that if, and obviously it will change, but you can see those early personalities and work out, well, this one may be a bit quieter, or if you want a small agility chihuahua, then you might want one who's a little bit more confident. And being able to have that conversation and have somebody who is interested in what your home is like and what the structure's like and the makeup of that home is almost more important than what age the dog, where you get it, because if they have that information and they're really interested in that information, then hopefully they'll do the best job possible of matching you to a dog that they hope will be successful, rather than just, you want a Chihuahua puppy, give me £600 and I'll meet you in a car park.
Can I ask, what behaviour assessments do you do when a dog comes in? Is there like a set of things that you do with that dog? Can you talk to me about that?
Yeah, definitely. So there's been quite a big shift happening over sort of, probably not even recent years now, but there's been a big shift happening. And in America, we still see, and probably over here in some places, it's just less common, we still see those kind of battery style assessments in rescue, which is, you know, here is a list of 20 things that you must do with that dog. And you note the response. So the kind of classic example is that assessor hand. So the fake hand.
Oh, the big hand.
Big food, and you put it in a food bowl. And, you know, that used to be sort of the done thing. But what we're sort of moving more towards now is a more sort of observational based assessment. Like we spend a lot of time in rescue interacting with our dogs, often not as much as we would like, but, you know, we should be able to use all of that information that we collect to build a picture of the dog, rather than a 20-minute assessment where quite often it might be a member of the behavior team who might not have worked with the dog before goes and gets that dog's out of kennels and then kind of sees how they react in different situations. That might just be going into reception and seeing how the dog reacts to people, rather than walking a fake doll up to the dog. But there's definitely a shift and a push to move, in my opinion, the right direction of, well, actually, if we've got a dog in rescue for 7 days, that's probably 14 times minimum that we're going to feed that dog, where we're going to walk into a kennel with a food bowl, put that food bowl down, maybe move a blanket that's away from the food bowl, walk out, and then go and get a food bowl later. Well, that's 14 opportunities for us to record information about how that dog responds around a food bowl. And it might be on day one, the dog seems uncomfortable around the food bowl, and then we shut them in or out, or, you know, somebody takes the dog out before the food bowl's removed. But in itself, that is sort of the highlight piece of information, isn't it? Like, the dog's uncomfortable around his food bowl, therefore the dog's uncomfortable around his food bowl. We don't really then need to go back and poke the dog with a fake hand to see, well, how far will the dog go? Because this is sort of anecdotally, but it is backed up in the literature as well. Most people actually don't see low-level resource guarding as that big an issue, because quite often it is really easy just to put the food bowl down and then walk away, isn't it? And then wait for the dog to not be eating from the food bowl to take the dog away. So some of the studies that was done in the US showed that actually owners don't really mind a lot of the time, as long as they know. And if we found that out on day one, why do we need to wait until day five to then try and do that in a new room to say the same thing? If we've got 14 opportunities where we fed the dog and the dog's been quite relaxed, it's pretty safe to say the dog's comfortable around their food bowl. And obviously any assessment that we do in a kennel environment or in a rescue environment is just based on that information that we get then and there, because the dog might seem okay around their food bowl because actually they're just really worried about the environment, so they're not doing anything. And then when they go into home, they might become a little bit more worried. And that's why it's really important that, as well as we having that information in an assessment, there's also some level of education for new owners coming in. So like a pre-adoption talk or some leaflets about body language, something that we can sort of give to owners to take away and look at, that's hopefully, like we've already mentioned a few times, going to set them and the dog up for success. So yeah, to answer your original question, it's changed a lot over the time, and it's hopefully moving more towards observational based. I took the dog for a walk, this happened, and that becomes our assessment.
Yeah, no, I love that, because I don't like that big hand that goes,
no, nor do I.
Goes into the food bowl and then strokes the dog. It's like, well, a lot of dogs would react to that big hand.
I think I'd react to that as well. Yeah. I was eating my dinner and somebody...
Get off my chips. Yeah, but behaviour is information, isn't it? Behaviour is information. So observation, yeah, is where it's at. But that's really good.
That's it, yeah.
Okay, so this is a little bit of a sensitive subject, but we may have some listeners listening to this episode that feel that they can't cope with their chihuahua anymore, maybe due to behavior issues, financial issues, or other reasons. Who can they contact, and what's the protocol for rehoming a dog?
Yeah, so it is a really tricky situation, isn't it? And there is a lot of stigma around rehoming and that sort of, you know, the situation people find themselves in. But the reality is sometimes, you know, it is the best decision for that owner and that dog. I think what's really important beforehand is to try and explore avenues if possible. So like you said, if it is a behavior issue, then there are a lot more of the large rescue organizations now who are offering sort of low-cost behavior support. If it is sort of veterinary treatment related, or even just food, you know, more of the organizations are kind of recognizing the cost of living now and looking at food banks and support with vet treatment. So really trying to explore those options to start with. The obvious one as well, just to mention quickly, is making sure that you've got insurance if you've got a dog, and then you know that's something that you don't have to find in a stressful situation. But if you have explored those options and you think, yeah, this definitely is the right decision for me, then looking at reputable rescues who can support you with that process, and you know the dog is going to have lifelong support from that organization. And probably the best place to look is the Associations of Dogs and Cats Homes, so the ADCH, and they've got a website with all of their members listed, so you can look at the organizations in your area. It might also be thinking about sort of what would be best for yours. Because if it is a dog who you think might really, really struggle with kennels, looking at some of the foster-based rescues, or some of the organisations like Dogs Trust and Blue Cross do like Homestay or Homes Direct, where you keep the dog whilst they look for a home and then the dog moves straight into a new home. So depending on your situation, that might be something that works better for you. But the biggest thing to remember is, you know, rescues are under a lot of pressure at the minute, so the more notice you can give or the more sort of support you can offer the rescue with rehoming your dog, the easier that conversation is going to be. But yeah, the ADCH is definitely sort of the place to look in the first instance.
Are rescue centres regulated, or can anyone just say I'm a rescue centre?
It's kind of tricky. So yeah, in the grand scheme of things, there's no sort of regulation for rescue, so anybody can set up an organization and, you know, set up as a charity or even not set up as a charity and start being a rescue. And particularly if you haven't got a premises, so you're doing sort of foster-based rescue, if you do have a kennels, then obviously you need a license, but that still doesn't specifically need to be a license for rescue and rehoming. But what there is, and what we've obviously just mentioned, is the ADCH, so the Association of Dogs and Cats Homes, and that is a self-regulation body. So that's a group of organizations who got together and said, you know, we should have standards, and yeah, we should have welfare standards and cleanliness standards and things, and they're sort of the main regulatory body, but it is voluntary to join up.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So that kind of goes into my last question, which is, where would you go if you were, what should you look for in a good rescue? But that would be a good starting point.
Yeah, so the ADCH website lists all of their member organisations, and they have set standards. And like I said, it includes welfare, it includes cleanliness and cleaning and all of that sort of stuff. And it's different grades, so that's a really great place to start looking. The RSPCA also do sort of a similar scheme, where they rate's probably not the right word, but they sort of look at different organizations and provide feedback on stuff on how to make welfare better. So that's always good places to start. And then the other side of it is looking at that support post-adoption. If you are taking a dog to be rehomed, unfortunately, or if you're looking to rehome a dog yourself, because you want to make sure that the rescue is always going to be there for the dog. Like you said, that might look very different for every rescue. So for some rescues, they might not have behavior support if somebody's struggling, but hopefully, you know, they can point you in the right direction. But you know, if you really can't cope or it just really isn't the right match, you've got somewhere for that dog to go back to. And we don't kind of end up in a system where you've got dogs who've come from rescue, then ended up on Gumtree or Facebook or somewhere. And then just speak to them, like ring them up on the phone and see how, you know, what they sound like, or if you can visit. Obviously it's changed a bit with since COVID, but if you can visit and have a look around, that's the best thing. And try and think on things. So, you know, you don't really want a rescue where you go meet a dog and then they're keen for you to sort of take the dog straight away. Like it might be within the next few days because there is so much pressure on space, but we want to make sure that you do have a chance to sort of think about the dog you've met and if it is the right fit. And the same when you go to a breeder, isn't it? You know, make sure you speak to them beforehand and you're not just going and then falling into the trap of seeing a really cute puppy and taking it home without really sort of thinking about it.
And would you say the rescue centre should be interviewing you as well, shouldn't they? They shouldn't just be like, you call up, I want a dog. They go, yeah, here you go. They should ask you, they should have questions for you, and as well as you should have questions for them.
Definitely, because it needs to be a bit of a partnership, really, because hopefully you're both there for the welfare of that dog and making sure that it's as successful a rehome as possible. And I think quite commonly, you know, it's said about training and behaviour as well, isn't it? Where people say, oh, I don't really like people. I want to work with dogs. So I'll work in rescue, or I'll work in training and behaviour. And it doesn't kind of work like that, because you actually need those people's skills to match those dogs well to the owners so that they're successful, both sides, and they both have the best experience of dog ownership as possible.
Thank you so much for coming on and talking to us. If our listeners want to get in touch with you or find out more information about your work, where can they find you?
So I don't have a website or anything, but what they can do is if they have any questions or want to find out anything else, then they can email me, and it's tom.candy.dog@gmail.com. If they email me there, then I should be able to get back to them.
We hope you've enjoyed this week's episode of the Chihuahua Podcast as much as we did. If you'd like to join in with the conversation, then please head over to our Facebook page, the Chihuahua Podcast. And we would love it if you would support the podcast by giving us a like, following, subscribing, telling your friends, or leaving us a 5-star review. See you next time. Bye-bye.